This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, February 24, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Immigration reform heats up again on Capitol Hill as President Bush extends a temporary immigration program. A new report indicates the EPA is not doing enough to warn residents returning to New Orleans of health risks. And Philippines President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo declares a state of emergency. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News. A Nigerian court has ordered Shell Petroleum to pay $1.5 billion to local communities in the Niger Delta region as compensation for years of environmental pollution. Samuel Okoye reports from Lagos.
The court judgment is another setback for the oil giant Shell, which early this week shut down half of its operations in Nigeria, following attacks on its facilities after the kidnapping of 9 of its foreign employees. Payment of compensation for environmental damage is one of the demands of the local militants holding the oil workers. Nigeria's National Assembly had previously passed a resolution compelling Shell to pay the $1.5 billion for ecological damage. The case went to court when Shell refused to pay. If Shell does not comply with today's court verdict, negotiations to secure the release of the hostages could become even more difficult. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
In Ecuador, the government-imposed state of emergency has been lifted in the Amazon province of Napo. This comes after troops were sent to the region to deal with protests against foreign and state-owned oil interests. Earlier in the week, protesters had occupied a pumping station that supplies the country's most important privately owned pipeline. They were calling for greater investment in the region. The government has now reportedly agreed to spend some $100 million on infrastructure projects and social spending programs. Residents in Argentina's central province of Córdoba rallied yesterday to protest a 200% increase in water rates. The hike was passed in December to subsidize debt from the French company that controls Córdoba's water utilities. Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
Throughout the week, local organizations, environmentalists, and residents organized road blockades in protest of the 200% rate increase in privatization of water. Suez, the French group controlling Córdoba's water utility, threatened to pull out of Argentina last year because of a government-mandated freeze on water rates. The provincial government agreed to forgive the company's $19 million debt as an incentive for the company to make long overdue investments in infrastructure. Local resident groups are pushing for the government to annul the Suez Aguas Córdoba contract and have proposed that users and employees form a public cooperative to manage water services. Hundreds of residents participating in the march say they will boycott Suez by not paying their water bills. Suez will soon install over 15,000 water meters to control and restrict water consumption. The company has said that users who do not pay their water bill will have their services cut. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
An outspoken Arizona environmental activist is in federal custody after a court hearing yesterday. Evan Davis has the story.
Environmental activist Rod Coronado was arraigned yesterday in a federal court in Tucson, Arizona, after federal agents arrested him on Wednesday. During yesterday's court appearance, Coronado was charged with felony distribution of information relating to a destructive device for allegedly giving instructions on how to create an incendiary device during a speech he gave in San Diego in 2003. A San Diego area housing development that was under construction was destroyed by arson less than 24 hours before Coronado's speech there, but Coronado is not being charged with setting the blaze, which Earth Liberation Front took credit for at the time. Coronado is being held in detention in Tucson and is expected to be transferred on Monday to a federal court in San Diego. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Arizona.
3,600 Teamsters union members are on strike against Connecticut-based Sikorsky Aircraft, which makes helicopters for civilian and military use. The strike began Monday over the failure to agree on health care coverage. Melinda Tuhus reports from the picket line.
On a warm day for February, dozens of strikers circled the main entrance to the plant. The feeling was relaxed, and horn honking in support from passing vehicles was raucous and constant. The average employee is 48 years old, with 25 years seniority, and health care is a big concern. Joe Rakan, a union official and 21-year employee, explains a trade-off with other benefits the workers are willing to make.
They understand that, you know what, healthcare is a national crisis, and we don't mind paying a little bit more. Just divert some of our money from our raises or our signing bonus towards that to keep the status quo. We're not asking for anything more.
The company says healthcare costs have risen 45% during the last 3 years. It wants to institute a 20% worker copay on health insurance, but the workers have rejected that, saying the company doesn't need to impose those costs to stay competitive. No talks are currently scheduled. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in Stratford, Connecticut.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Philippines President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo declared a state of emergency today amid massive anti-government demonstrations and an alleged coup plot. FSRN's Gurley Linao reports from Manila.
Clashes broke out between policemen and protesters a few hours after President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo declared a state of emergency, sparking a security crackdown. Rallies were banned, classes were suspended, and security was stepped up around the presidential palace. In declaring emergency rule, Arroyo ordered the military and police to hunt down those believed to be behind a plot to overthrow her government. Officials said under the state of emergency, the government can also take over utilities and companies that threaten national interests, including media agencies. The Philippines was placed under emergency rule as it celebrated the 20th anniversary of a people power revolt that ousted late dictator Ferdinand Marcos in 1986 and restored democracy. Former President Corazon Aquino, who was propelled into power by the 1986 uprising, was among more than 15,000 people who defied the ban on rallies and marched to again call for Arroyo's resignation.
I have no intention to violate our laws. My only appeal is the same appeal I made when I went to the presidential palace last year when I asked President Gloria Arroyo
to make the supreme sacrifice of resigning. And I would like to reiterate that call.
Arroyo's opponents warn she has practically placed the country under a de facto martial rule. They urge Filipinos to be vigilant and not to allow democracy to be stolen again. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurley Linao in Manila.
Our correspondent Gurley Linao joins us on the line from Manila. As you mentioned in your report, today marks a very important day in Filipino history. 20 years ago, the People Power Revolt finally removed then-President Ferdinand Marcos. What are residents there saying about the president's move to call this state of emergency?
Critics are saying that the president has actually declared a de facto martial rule in the Philippines. They think that the emergency rule is creating panic among the public and that it could even spark more tensions and violence in the streets.
So are people saying that it's perhaps a type of military rule in practice, even if it's not military rule in name?
Yes, critics of the president are saying that with the deployment of the military and deployment of the police all over the capital and also in other key urban cities in the provinces, that this is practically martial rule. And just a few hours ago, there was a report of the police already raiding an office of a newspaper that is against the government. And many are afraid that there will be more of such activities in the coming days.
And that tension and violence in years past has been called people power and has contributed to some type of political change. Has that political change really been embraced? Who has it benefited in these last 20 years?
Well, we've had two mass uprisings already since 1986. We had another one in 2001. This time when people are calling for Filipinos to join the demonstrations against President Arroyo, we don't see much of the Filipinos going out. The crowd is very little compared to the crowd that we saw in 1986 and 2001. And many analysts are saying that this is because none of the people who went to the rallies then have benefited from the uprisings, that we still see the same group of leaders ruling the country. We still see the elitists ruling the country and not much happening for the poor.
Finally, the provision that Arroyo used to call the state of emergency usually refers to a response to economic emergency, not some type of coup attempt. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Legal experts are saying that this provision that Arroyo has invoked is actually used to help the government crack down on any situation that worsens the country's economy. And this provision allows the government to take over utilities and companies that are threatening national interests. But the government has been saying that the economy is doing well. The peso is up against the U.S. dollar. The stock market is up. Investors are supposed to be coming in. And there is a question on whether the government is just trying to use this so that they could be able to crack down on its political opponents.
Girlie Linao is our correspondent in the Philippines. She joined us today from Manila. President Bush met with Salvadoran President Elias Antonio Saca at the White House this afternoon, where the two leaders discussed the Central American Free Trade Agreement, although the main topic of discussion was immigration. President Saca is pushing for a comprehensive immigration reform program that would assign legal status to Salvadoran immigrants already in the United States. President Bush offered a bit of immigration relief by announcing that he would extend a temporary program allowing some Salvadoran and other Central American immigrants to stay in the U.S. with temporary status for another year. But as Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports, some members of Congress are vowing to defeat that extension.
The extension of the Temporary Protection Status Program, or TPS, will allow 300,000 Salvadorans, Hondurans, and Nicaraguans lawfully living in the United States to remain in the U.S. for another year. Chris Bentley is a spokesperson for the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services under the Department of Homeland Security.
We reevaluate the conditions in the country as the TPS status is nearing its expiration and then make a determination on whether it is safe to send the individuals back to their home country or whether the infrastructure there is not in place to allow that to happen and the TPS should be extended for additional time here stateside.
The government determined that the conditions are not adequate for immigrants to return. TPS is a program that gives citizens of certain foreign countries refuge in the United States because their home country is affected by war or a natural disaster. Currently, immigrants from 7 countries are in the United States under this status. Ana Margarita Chavez is Consulate General at the Salvadoran Consulate in Washington, D.C. She says this decision prolongs stability in the Americas.
If, for example, they go back, the people that are here in the United States, they go back to El Salvador, probably they wouldn't find the opportunities that they need to work, and then our democracy would be in jeopardy.
The details haven't yet been released, except that immigrants whose status was set to expire in July will remain lawful until July of 2007. And immigration opponents are angry. Jack Martin is Special Projects Director at the Federation for American Immigration Reform, or FAIR.
It is not justified by humanitarian conditions, which was the reason for adopting this program. The extension is being done simply as a political decision.
Several Latin American countries are pushing the United States for more open immigration policies. President Bush revealed his plan during a meeting with Salvadoran President Elias Antonio Saca, who was pleased with the decision. But critics say this is just another form of amnesty. Opposition also arose on Capitol Hill. While some members applaud the move, others say the president's decision is unacceptable. Republican Representative Tom Tancredo from Colorado and chair of the Immigration Reform Caucus, that is a group of congressional members who oppose immigration. He was unavailable to come on air with Free Speech Radio News, but in a statement, Tancredo says the administration doesn't understand the word temporary. He says immigrants never return to their home countries after they receive temporary status in the United States. Tancredo says he will try to stop this decision through the legislative process. Furthermore, broad sweeping immigration reform will be debated in both the House and the Senate this year. The Senate Judiciary Committee has stalled the introduction of the bill because of large demonstrations from both immigration opponents and supporters. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, has warned sectarian violence is a threat to the future of Iraq following the bombing of the Samarra Shrine this week. As the country remains tense with the continued presence of U.S. and coalition troops, a U.S. congressman who is a previous supporter of the war and sits on the House Appropriations Committee has called for troops to return. FSRN's Rebecca Miles files this report.
In New Jersey yesterday, Democratic Congress member Steve Rothman said he backed President Bush after the attacks on September 11th, accepting his counsel that Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat. Rothman said after Hussein was deposed by the military, it turned out virtually everything President Bush had told the American people and Congress was untrue.
There was no imminent threat to the national security of the United States. Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction, and he was not sending Iraqi agents into our country. But because of the horrific management of the war, really without a strategy by the Bush administration, the country, its infrastructure was nearly all destroyed. The people were thrown out of their jobs. The middle class was dispersed. Many of us felt we had a moral responsibility to stay in that country to help these people establish a stable government, hopefully a democratic government. It's now been 3 years since the war began, and we've lost 2,200 young servicemen and women of our country, more than 16,000 wounded, more than 100,000 Iraqi dead, more than a quarter of $1 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money spent on this war, with virtually no progress in terms of reconstructing the country or providing stability. We have done more than enough, paid the price in blood and money. It is time to bring our troops home.
Rayad Jarrah is an Iraqi citizen who's currently in the U.S. and lived in Iraq through the invasions and has written the Iraqi Roadmap, an exit plan, and thinks civil war is only likely if the U.S. troops stay.
There is an ongoing civil tension and clashes since the invasions that are happening with so many casualties every week. But, I mean, there is no possibility that Iraqis will start having big-scale civil war like the Lebanese case. Iraq currently is like a room full of gas that will explode. It just needs one spark to explode. And the U.S. Army should not be there anymore.
As Congress member Rothman added, President Bush will be regarded as the worst, if not the worst ever, president in U.S. history. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
A national environmental group has charged that the Environmental Protection Agency is not doing enough to warn residents returning to New Orleans of health risks. The report released yesterday by the National Resources Defense Council is the latest in a series of charges by the NRDC and other groups that the EPA is ignoring its own guidelines in dealing with the contamination caused by post-Katrina flooding. Christian Roseland has more from the Crescent City.
Even if the truths are hard, we still need to hear the truth.
Pam DeShiel of the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association says that she has been trying to get accurate information on contamination in New Orleans for years before the storm, and that returning residents would not know about the severe contamination issues in the city without the NRDC.
We would not have known the extent of the problem, and nor would we have understood its significance. And that's, I mean, it just seems that a private nonprofit organization that does not have the vast resources of the EPA has provided more of a public benefit in terms of information and analysis than the EPA has.
The report released yesterday states that the levels of lead, arsenic, and dangerous petroleum compounds in multiple locations around the city should have triggered a massive cleanup or at least further investigation. The NRDC's report follows an independent peer-reviewed study released last Monday by Texas Tech and Xavier Universities, which found higher levels of contaminants in the soil than previous EPA tests. Tom Harris of Louisiana's Department of Environmental Quality responded by telling the Washington Post yesterday that the NRDC was grossly misusing the EPA data and said that the state's threshold levels would have to be greatly exceeded before children are harmed. DeShiel says that the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association has joined the NRDC in calling for toxic soil in the city to be removed and replaced. She says that soil contamination is not an issue to be underestimated.
Well, people do grow vegetables and flowers in their yards that they bring into their homes. Children play outside. Old people in New Orleans, people sit outside all the time. I mean, that's part of our great culture. And so soil contamination is a real issue.
For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
Human rights activists have hailed a judgment handed down today in a case related to the 2002 sectarian violence in the western Indian state of Gujarat as a triumph of truth and justice. 9 of 21 defendants charged in a lower court under directions from India's Supreme Court were sentenced to life in prison. The decision has stirred new optimism for the Muslims who had lost all hope in the investigations and the trials run by the Gujarat government. FSRN's Benu Alex reports from Vadodara, India.
The scene was gloomy at the colony where 9 were sentenced to life, at least 14 years in prison for murder. The television channels broke the news and woman broke down. The high-profile Best Bakery case is related to the 2002 riots in the western state of Gujarat. 2 months of violence between Hindus and Muslims resulted in the death of more than 1,000 Muslims, scores of women raped, and property destroyed. The violence began after a suspected Muslim mob burned a train coach carrying Hindu activists during February 2002. The case took many twists and turns where the accused were previously acquitted in the original trial after the prosecution's main witness, Zahira Sheikh, retracted her testimony. She then changed her stance again and again and blamed Teesta Setalwat, the human rights activist who once helped her, of intimidation. It was at Teesta's persistence that the case was shifted out of Gujarat to neighboring Mumbai by the Supreme Court.
We are really hopeful that the findings of the Honorable Sessions Judge here will have a very positive bearing. And personally, as our group, we are very satisfied because the judge has clearly held that whatever was said against me was completely false and defamatory.
The court also found Zahira Sheikh and her family guilty of lying under oath and issued a notice asking them to explain why they turned into hostile witnesses. The case was widely considered as a mark to symbolize the failure of the Indian justice system following the Gujarat riots in 2002. And many Muslims say their hope in getting justice is rejuvenated. Zubair Memon is one such Muslim in Vadodara.
One thing that is proven because of this judgment is that justice prevails in India. Many people asked me whether this judgment will divide Hindus and Muslims further. We believe a criminal should only be seen as a person who committed a crime and not someone whose actions are representative of his religion.
Father Cedric Prakash, who has been actively demanding justice for the victims, terms the judgment as a triumph of truth.
This is the first step towards reconciliation, towards peace, and ultimately communal harmony in Gujarat. Let's hope that this becomes the precedence for the several other cases which need to be reopened and for which justice has to be delivered in the wake of the Gujarat carnage of 2002.
After 4 years and several acquittals, Special Court conducting a retrial found the 9 guilty of killing 14 people during the arson attack on the bakery. Anger is simmering at Hanuman Tekri, the colony where all the accused are from. Deserted by the political parties and right-wing Hindu activists, the families are on the verge of social and financial collapse. Shardaban Rajbhar, mother of one of the convicted, is inconsolable. She is castigating the right-wing BJP party government for isolating them at the time when they wanted their support. The verdict is seen as a slap in the face of Narendra Modi, the Chief Minister of Gujarat, who is widely accused by human rights activists of presiding over the violence, which lasted more than 2 months. There are more than 2,000 cases on trial, and this judgment may just prove as a trendsetter in delivering justice. From Vadodara in India, I'm Peter Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
As Black History Month comes to a close, some people take this time to reflect, remember, and rejoin the history and achievements of African Americans, even as recent comments made by actor Morgan Freeman have stirred up debate on whether Black History Month is necessary. Selena Masuta reports on that discussion from Washington, D.C., hometown of Black History Month founder Dr. Carter G. Woodson.
On a cold, windy day in Washington, D.C., 30 people huddle in one of the many chapels in Shiloh Baptist Church to sing the Negro National Anthem, a song that has passed through the lips of many this month. In 1926, Dr. Carter Godwin Woodson, a historian, teacher, and publisher, established Negro History Week, what we now know as Black History Month. Woodson spent much of his life in Washington, D.C., once known as Chocolate City, a hub of Black intellectualism and movement building. Earlier this month, actor Morgan Freeman declared that Black History Month was not needed, causing a flurry of debate on the significance of the month. Freeman argued that relegating Black history to a month is an obstacle to ending racism. However, there is sharp criticism of that view from people like Alexander M. Pajo. Pajo is the director of Shaw Main Streets, a group that partly works on preserving the history of the Howard Shaw area, including the legacy of Woodson.
Dr. Woodson really prayed for a day when there would not be a need to have a Negro History Week anymore. And the reason for that would be because it would be part of the history that would be in all the history books, not just Black history books. And it, you know, there would be monuments to African-American heroes and sheroes. But unfortunately, we're not where Dr. Woodson wanted us to be before Black History Month could be dissolved.
In the month of February, stories from elders like Lillian Gordon are foundations for plays and musical tributes that remind the nation of a time when racial segregation was legal. As a girl and later on as a young woman, Miss Gordon lived side by side in the Shaw area with historical figures like Woodson and A. Philip Randolph.
We were the only Blacks in our block at the time, and they had a place called Opportunity House that they would come and give the white kids all kind of goodies and had programs for them. And my sister and I used to go there and watch them. The people that were in charge of the program would never allow my sister and I to go.
And while stories of hardships and success before integration are important to highlight during Black History Month, sometimes there's little attention to present-day struggles, says Ayohandi Kendi, founder and director of the African American Holiday Association.
We aren't quite as up-to-date with the contributions that every single day each of us are making towards creating history in the making.
Well, Isaac Franklin based himself.
In the basement of Washington, D.C.'s main library, a line forms. People wait eagerly to ask questions to historian and educator C.R. Gibbs. February is the busiest month for Gibbs, who lectures across the country on Black history that people have little knowledge of. Gibbs hopes that African American communities will use history as a tool when even fighting against the takeover of neighborhoods by developers.
It is critical that you not only know the history of your block, but the history of your neighborhood, the history of your people, so that you can weave all of these strands together to form a fabric that will help you fight those who would cheat you of your birthright, rob you of your neighborhood, and kill your residential identity. I've called it residential genocide, and we've got to fight residential genocide. And the only way to do this, to begin with, is to have a knowledge of who we are and then a knowledge of where we are.
From Washington, D.C., I'm Selena Masuda.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Pogado.